bring that to light and just kind of let you know again that independent study programs will help you do this stuff on your own. And to, if you really want to learn this stuff well or teach it to your kids, check in with our Art of Mentoring programs. I think you'll really enjoy them. So get in touch with our school if you want more information, but in the meantime, I'm going to continue on our journey into the language of the birds. I put out a tape a while back, actually a tape series called Seeing Through Native Eyes. And that tape series, which is very much a part of Independent Studies 1, will take you into a pretty sophisticated journey on how to become a naturalist in your local area. And I will still reiterate the importance of that to learning the language of the birds. There's going to be a point at which you can't learn anything more about birds unless you understand their environment. And so I'm not going to get too much into the detail of what that's like, basically because I have a six-tape series that already does that in pretty good detail. And as I said before, if you're going to get serious about this and you really want us to help you along, if you join up with the Independent Studies programs at Wilderness Awareness School, you'll have to listen to those tapes anyway. There's no accident there. You have to learn your place in order to really interpret bird language. So I will be referring a lot throughout this tape series to knowledge of place. And whenever I do say that, remind yourself that at some point you got to know the birds as well as the trees and the plants, the animals that creep around in your forest, and the ecology, how it all fits together through seasons, through times of day. All that will be gained through what we call the Independent Study Program of Wilderness Awareness School. The last tape in that series, Seeing Through Native Eyes, the sixth tape, we call Seeing Through the Eyes of the Forest. In other words, looking through the bird's eyes to understand and interpret what's going on in the woods around us. It's also called The Language of the Birds, I think, on the cover. I'm going to review some of the concepts from that tape really quickly to use that as a jumping off point here. But if you really want to get more, just go ahead and get that tape and listen to it. Start that series by remembering driving down the Garden State Parkway with Tom Brown and complaining that there was no more predators around and we didn't have any reason to pay attention. And he had reminded me that the predators were still here. In other words, the vibration that's put out by a predator hunting is still there for us to read. And he pointed it out by saying, look up ahead on the left. And up there on the left was a state trooper hidden from view. He couldn't have seen it before we got there. But he knew it was there before we got there, based on what he was picking up from the concentric rings that particular predator put out. We're tying together the instinctive or spiritual aspects of awareness with bird language because they're highly linked. In Tom's approach to this whole thing, he talks a lot about concentric rings. And the way he learned it, if you read the book The Tracker or The Search by Tom Brown Jr., you'll get a sense of how he learned it from Stalking Wolf, the kind of work Stalking Wolf put him through in order to learn his place. That when your brain becomes that thoroughly patterned in awareness, you begin to pick up powerful antenna abilities, I guess we could say. Maybe you develop really strong receivers that pick up really subtle information from the landscape around you. It's not a whole lot different from the instincts of a really wise old buck or a wise old wolf who's raising her young. They have the ability to sense things that we can't sense. But that has everything to do with sensory training. If you want to get a sense of what that's like, how would you really learn at that level? I recommend that you read The Tracker or The Search. If you want to get a sense of who Stalking Wolf was, you can read the book Grandfather, and that will kind of give you a clue. Or The Way of the Scout will also give you a clue as to how this knowledge is applied in the context of the Apaches. Okay, so the predators are here. And we now know that bird language is a gateway to our instincts, that bird language will help us get out of our troubled thought process. Most of our troubles, it seems, are generated by our thinking mind and not by our instincts. And when you have to listen a lot, when you come to your senses, when you really listen a lot and pay attention with all of your senses, your mind will eventually silence itself. I mean, that thinking mind will quiet down. And we call that coming to the sacred silence, entering the sacred silence, that is living in that space where you can choose to think or not to think, that you could actually just be sort of like a reflective pond, reflecting the stars on, in the night. And that's ultimately where you want to get to. That's baseline for human consciousness, and the baseline that you need to get to in order to understand bird language. Birds are an excellent way to get that and get to that place. They become a really powerful team of coaches that, in a very sophisticated and exciting manner, bring you to the sacred silence. So we call that losing our minds and coming to our senses. We also talk a little bit on that tape about how a lot of this is really answering an ancient call within ourselves, things that we knew as kids. It triggers instinctive response, not just instinct itself as a way of sensing invisible information, but also instinct in terms of our pre-programmed response to things. You'll see that you'll start to feel like a kid when you begin to practice bird language. There's no accident there either. You're triggering something really ancient. And I talked a lot about diversity. There's so many different kinds of birds. How in the heck are we ever going to learn all this bird language? But I remind you that five voices of the birds only has to be applied to a handful of birds. And specifically, I'm going to really, really emphasize now that you should really only learn one bird really well. And of course, the one I always recommend to everybody is the American robin. If you live in a place where the American robin lives, that is, it's right outside your yard. In fact, a good sign of this tape session here was that some of the people in the audience here today noticed that right outside the window on the light post, there was a robin sitting watching us through the picture window. That's exactly the kind of bird that you want to teach you, the bird that's always in your yard. And I don't think there's very many yards in America, North America, that don't have a robin available to you to learn from at least the month of March until probably September or October. In the winter, there'll be other birds in your area, and I think your first assignment will be to figure out which bird is it that lives in my yard, that's always there, that can teach me. And if the birds change between summer and winter for you, then which bird in winter and which bird in summer? But really, which bird, not what birds. And we're looking at focusing on one bird so we can understand the language of one bird and therefore learn to apply that learning to all other birds that we encounter. The first bird is the hardest bird to learn, but every bird after that that you learn the language of, you'll pick up faster and faster. And that's definitely true. I know that from experience, not only my own, but from watching other people learn bird language. So don't worry about the fact that there may be over 200 species in your bioregion. I don't really worry about that, and you shouldn't either. What we're really after is which birds are right next to your house. Because the most successful people in bird language are the ones who practice, and the ones who have birds in their yard that they learn from are the ones who practice. Simple as that. If you pick birds that are in your yard, it'll be easy for you to practice. You can even practice while sitting in your living room. You can leave your windows open and watch out the windows. Literally. And so that's good news for people who live in the city also. You might be saying, well, I live in the city, this stinks, I'm not going to be able to learn bird language. That's not true. There's plenty of birds in the city that are always around your apartment building or always around, you know, the park up the street. Remember that. Those are the ones that you learn from, the ones that you see every day. They're the ones that talk to you the most. If you live in another place like Europe or other parts of the world where there are no American robins, you have to have something that's like an American robin. Every yard has something that is the guardian of the yard. So figure out which one it is. The key to it is that you're after birds that are ground feeders. They might live in the trees, they may nest in the trees, but what you really want to learn from is ground feeding birds, because they're the ones who, like you, are anchored to the ground in some part of their life cycle. And because they're on the ground feeding, that means they also have to be aware of the sound of alarms of approaching ground predators. All birds have to be aware of aerial predators. So there's no advantage to picking a treetop bird, because it will tell you about aerial predators, but it won't tell you about ground predators. It could care less what's going on the ground. So that's why we emphasize ground birds. Ground birds tend to be black, gray, or brown, at least partially in their coloration. So So you might think, well, a robin has an orange breast. But a robin doesn't have like an aureole orange breast. It doesn't have a radiant orange breast. It has a sort of subdued orange color that, when it's in the shadows, blends right in. It's really actually pretty good camouflage. So just keep an eye on the robin of your yard and learn the five voices for that robin. And then you'll learn to apply that later to other birds, like song sparrows. That's another top 10 bird for me. So what are these five voices? Well, I explained kind of briefly on this tape that the five voices of the birds are four baseline behaviors and one alarm behavior. So there's four baseline voices and one alarm voice. So if we look at the five voices really quickly again, the song is what we would call the territorial behavior of the bird. That is, the bird has mapped out a specific area of your yard or of your secret spot area where it's singing a song. As it, some birds actually go around the border of their territory, like the common yellowthroat does that, where it travels a sort of circuit around its territory, singing kind of all day long while it's setting up its territory. So it's actually laying out its boundary for you. You can actually watch it tell you where its boundaries are as it sings around the edge of its territory. Other birds will sit up in a tree, like a robin, take a post in its territory, a visible post where it can see all over its territory, and it will sing from that place. And it establishes its boundaries by scuffling with other males. So you learn to figure out where your robin's territory is by where other birds fight with it. You know, so when you see male-to-male aggression happening around the edge of the robin's territory, it's kind of telling you where its territory is. There's another way you can tell where the robin's territory is, and that is to simply watch it and figure out where it never goes. You know, you'll see it's always here, it's always there, it's always sitting in this place, it always goes to that fence post, it always sits on that lamppost, but I never see it cross the street. So what you're finding out from where it doesn't go is where its territory seems to end. The other thing you might notice about a bird that's singing in its territory is that it'll be really sort of obvious. It'll have real demonstrative body language. It'll be really visible and vocal in its territory. But should it sneak out past the edge of its territory to get that one juicy worm that it sees just beyond the border, you'll notice that it quiets down a lot and acts real sneaky and suspicious. So that's something to pay attention to. You're going to really want to use the song, and of course the song doesn't apply except in the early spring into the early summer. The song is kind of only useful during the springtime of the year. When we get around to talk about bird language through the seasons, we'll get back to that in pretty good detail. So think about the song as not only an expression of territoriality, but also an expression of baseline. The bird is in a very peaceful, contented state of mind when it's singing. It couldn't possibly sing if it was alarmed. So just remember that. So song is an indication of baseline. You'll notice that when the robin is singing, the song sparrow is singing, the treetop birds are singing. You'll notice that when the cat comes through the yard and alarms the robin and alarms the song sparrow, that the grosbeak is still singing. So if you were just listening to birdsong as a sign of alarm, you would get the wrong impression, because you'd hear that grosbeak singing and say, ah, I hear a songbird, there must be no alarms going on. But if you really listened and paid attention, you would notice that all the ground birds have shut up and are issuing their alarm calls, or they're displaying intense body language that says that they're nervous right now. So you have to understand that treetop birds in this context, their songs, though beautiful, don't necessarily indicate anything in terms of alarms on the ground. Because when you live 175 feet up in a dug fir tree, it doesn't really matter what the robin is doing down there. It's like a whole nother universe, a whole different perspective. And birds like to conserve energy. Energy conservation is vital to their existence. It takes a lot to live out there. If you've ever been a person who's practiced actually living off the land by eating things from the landscape and only feeding yourself off the landscape, you know how difficult that can be. Imagine feeding your family. In fact, imagine feeding five starving teenagers off the landscape. And then you'll know why birds like to conserve energy, because it's not easy to come up with energy, not only for your kids, but for yourself. And especially during that time of year when they're singing, they have to conserve energy dramatically. And that's why it doesn't pay for the grosbeak to be too wrapped up in what the robins are doing. It just doesn't make any sense from an energy conservation point of view. It might be curious. It might hear the alarms down on the ground and pause in its song for an instant and look down to see what's going on, but quickly go back to singing again. So remember to discern treetop bird song from ground bird song. That's a really important concept. Okay, in understanding bird language. Now, companion calls, these are what I would call the sweetest and most empathetic songs of the birds, or sounds that the birds give off. My favorite story is of the cardinal, which I tell on the Native Eyes Tape 6, the cardinal pair talking back to each other in a rhythmic and continuous pattern. And I want to emphasize that. Also, okay, the community school noticed that bird vocalizations came out in patterns that you could actually measure by a clock, like that every 11 seconds this bird would repeat its song, and they began to realize that everything happening out in nature was happening in a rhythmic, measurable pattern. That's one of the first things you notice, not only about songs, but certainly about companion calls. And it seems to me that it's more vital in the companion call sequence than anywhere else. And companion calls are the sounds, you know, that when you get your field guide to the bird song tape or your Lang Elliott Birds of the Backyard tape and you're listening to it, they don't really call it an alarm as much. They just simply call it a call note. So in your field guides, you'll notice that they don't really talk about alarm notes specifically or companion calls. That's my terminology that I'm applying to this. The companion call is a sound that's uttered between the male and the female. Or sometimes if there's a flock, for instance, of white-throated sparrows feeding their way through the underbrush in a forest, they're all giving off this call every so many seconds. As you train your ears to really pay attention to companion calls, you'll notice that they, like songs, are repeated in very specifically timed rhythms, intervals. And that a cardinal, if it gives off an alarm and its mate doesn't answer in so many seconds, it will become alarmed itself. It's like, what happened to you? Where are you? You know, and you'll hear them talking back to each other. Sorry about that, I just was eating a bug at the moment. Don't do that. Okay. And then they go right back to their rhythm again. So remember those companion calls. They're important. So they basically, you might also call them feeding calls. Certain birds, like towhees, don't necessarily give off a companion call vocally, but they give it off instead in rhythmic patterns with their feet. Like they're scratching the leaves. Then they listen. And they listen. And they listen. So they're not continuously making that noise with their feet, but they're doing it in rhythmic patterns. And that becomes like a companion call. Because there's no point in making a vocal sound if your mate is making so much noise with its own feet that it can't really hear. And I think that towhees hear subsonic sounds also, sounds that we can't hear that have to do with low frequency, because they seem to respond to things that I can't hear before all the other birds do. And that probably has to do with the fact that they make so much noise while they're feeding that they have to have another form of communication. Towhees also use visual cues, as do juncos. They flash their black and white tail patterns in a rhythmic pattern also, and that flashing pattern is like a companion call. So just so you know, an interruption suddenly in companion calls may be an alarm. So if you hear that continuous repeating rhythmic sequence of the companion calls around you and suddenly it stops, that's just as much of an alarm as an alarm note, an actual sound given. So interruption in companion calls or feeding calls is a sign of alarm. So the baseline version of communication for birds that are actually working, you know, feeding, preening, moving about, is the companion call. Songs are only useful during that time of year. The companion calls are used year-round. Male-to-male aggression I referred to with the robin. When two males encounter each other over a territorial boundary issue, they'll chase each other around And beginning bird listeners always think that that's an alarm. They immediately see this intense energy. They hear all this noise. They often hear wings beating against leaves, and they hear, you know, what amounts to sounds like little shrieks of pain and surprise as these birds chase each other frantically around. It seems like a hawk is trying to eat a bird, you know, but when you really pay attention, you'll notice that it's actually a robin chasing a robin. When you see that, you're looking usually at male to male, or at least what we would call territorial aggression. It's not always male to male. For instance, you might see a cardinal chase a flicker out of a tree because it has a nest in that tree, that sort of thing. So it's not always in between the same species, but it often is. You'll learn to recognize it by watching what robins do, and then you'll learn to recognize that body language in other situations. I watched a robin chase a red-bellied woodpecker from a mulberry tree the other day, and that had to do with the fact that the robin's nest was in that mulberry tree, and the red-bellied woodpecker was just coming into the tree to feed. But the aggressive behavior, the display, the vocalizations, all that were just like the same ones that the male uses when it chases a male out of its territory. So you can recognize that territorial aggression that way. Begging calls. These are what happen around, you know, say, starting the end of May into June, depending on when birds are actually fledging their young, when these birds that look for all the world like adults are begging to be fed in a really loud manner. This time of year, during that time of year, you hear especially things like crows incessantly, almost whining and begging and whining and begging. It really irritates you after a while. You'll notice up on the roof of the convenience store, these three young crows begging and begging, and the mom kind of bringing a hunk of bread over and stuffing it in the mouth. And that's how you recognize begging calls. It's just so loud and raucous, especially with crows, that you'll really learn what it looks like from crows. But there are certain times of year when it never stops. It seems like it just goes all day long. You know, fortunately, only lasts a few days. But you'll notice it with all of the songbirds. And it's important to recognize that we are talking about songbirds primarily in this tape series, but I will bring in other birds later in this tape series. Songbirds are the birds from Passeriformes, the order Passeriformes, otherwise known as perching birds. And these are birds that look like robins, more or less, in their profile. They hang onto branches and they sing and they have territories and all that sort of thing. And this would be distinct from things like geese or herons or hawks. But again, I will bring those birds into this discussion later too, because their information is just as important. The reason we focus on songbirds is A, because they're all around your yard, B, because they sing, and so they're easy to track, and C, because they're the ones that have invested the most energy into bird language themselves, so you'll get the most information from them. When we think about the begging calls of songbirds, I bring in something now which we'll come back to later, which is it seems that nature abhors adolescent behavior. You've heard the saying that nature abhors a vacuum. Well, this is a pretty strong statement here. Nature abhors adolescent behavior. And what is adolescent behavior? Basically, it seems to be self-centered to a fault, where all you're concerned about is yourself. I want this now for me. I want this now. And I want it now vocalized as a begging call in the birds. And the sharp-shinned hawks exist, Cooper's hawks, goshawks exist, it seems, to comb adolescent behavior out of the forest during the spring of the year. All they have to do, because they have begging adolescents back at their nest, all they have to do is cruise through the forest, kind of in a glide, looking left and right as they go, listening for that distinctive begging call. Now, the mother bird knows the sharp-shinned is coming because the alarm is being broadcast way out in front of the sharp-shinned hawk. The mother knows it's coming, the father knows it's coming, and they quickly hide at the last second. Now, the juveniles that pay attention that aren't too self-absorbed will notice that the parents have ditched it, listen to the parent's alarm call, and actually pay attention to it and follow the parent bird. but there's usually one sitting out on the branch after everyone ditches it who's more self-absorbed and more concerned about their own needs in the moment than the parents would have approved of, and basically they'll be begging and begging and begging, and then you'll hear a kind of a sudden silence, maybe a little shriek, and a puff of feathers will result as that sharp-shinned hawk takes off with the begging starling. You know, and the amazing thing is, if you watch a sharp-shinned hawk nest for any length of time, you know, during that time of year, say June, it's startling how often the mother and the father sharp-shinned hawk bring adolescent birds in, about every 10, 15 seconds sometimes, it seems. They're flying in with another starling. And the thing is, they'll fly in, nail a starling, right in front of all the other starlings, right? So if there's three or four sibling starlings all begging in the same berry bush to be fed, those three or four siblings just watch their sister or brother get, you know, taken away by a sharp-shinned hawk. The amazing thing is that those siblings don't learn the lesson. And that sharp-shinned hawk will come right back to that exact location, not 20 seconds later or a minute later, and do the exact same thing with one of the other siblings. So it's not unusual for a parent bird to lose an entire clutch once they go into that adolescent behavior, right? So they have to start all over again. So if you're wondering why it is that you're still finding robin eggs in the month of July, that's part of the explanation, that these robins fall prey to their adolescent behavior. They can't seem to break out of their own self-absorbed needs in the moment long enough to become aware. So that's where the intense awareness of the birds actually begins. If they live through adolescence, maybe they get grazed by the talons of a sharp-shinned hawk. Maybe underneath those feathers, they bear the scars on their back of talons that scraped by and they escaped at the last second. It's usually that kind of a, you know, intense close-to-death experience that wakes these animals up enough to get them to pay attention. And that's also true in human beings. I mean, I know that to be true from, you know, learning from naturalists, trackers, hunters, native people. They all have stories like that. They've all gotten close to death and experienced a close encounter with death that makes them pay attention at a much higher level than people who live in a modern experience where they're protected all the time. So that's what I was saying in the very beginning of this tape series. It's hard for us to relate to the level of awareness that a bird has to have in order to live. You know, if they've lived through their adolescence and gotten past this time, past the time of begging calls, they are really invested in paying attention. They've probably watched, you know, if not five or six, dozens of relatives get popped by things like sharp-shinned hawks. They eventually learn to pay attention, or they don't live. So not all birds out there are the same, and I really have to emphasize that. You know, you look out there and you say, oh, there's a song sparrow, and there's another song sparrow, and up the street there's another song sparrow. You might think to yourself that they're all kind of the same, but they may not be the same. One of those song sparrows might be 7 years old. If there's a song sparrow living in your neighborhood that's lived through seven seasons, 7 years, it's really got a lot of wisdom. And that would be a bird to watch. And over time, you know, I spent 7 years going to the same secret spot. I became familiar with certain individual birds that I saw year after year after year. And I began to recognize that those birds saw and knew things that no other birds knew and saw in their forest. It was very similar to, you know, in our community of learners, you might look at somebody like Stalking Wolf and say, wow, this person had, he was a human being like every other human being, but he possessed great knowledge of the landscape. So this is the same here. You know, you wouldn't compare Stalking Wolf's knowledge to the knowledge of, say, a person that you pull off the street. The person off the street doesn't know anywhere near as much about the forest as Stalking Wolf, therefore they behave differently. It's the same with the birds. You know, and you especially see it emphasized here among the begging juvenile birds. It really drives home the lesson. So learn to recognize that begging call thing and pay particular attention. When you hear begging calls, you might think, well, everything's fine because this bird is begging to be fed. Therefore, the forest must be in baseline. That's only partially true, because a begging bird may not know enough to shut up, and it might still be begging long after the sharp-shinned has sped through, killed his sister, and flown off to its nest. That begging bird might just still be begging, right? The way to tell if a begging bird is actually a sign of baseline or not is to look around and see what everyone else is doing. More than once, I've seen a lone robin or a lone starling sitting out in the open on a bush begging, when everyone else was dead silent and there wasn't a bird to be seen. That's because the Sharpshin just came through. So chances are if I had been there 10 minutes earlier, there would have been two begging birds, not one begging bird. So learn to recognize begging calls. Okay, now, I want to repeat something that energy conservation priority that birds possess means that a bird will only go as far as it possibly has to go in order to be safe. And I use this little saying here. How far does a bird go to escape danger? The answer is always far enough. Okay, that's a relative term. So if the danger is small and localized, that bird will only rise so many feet above the ground, above that small localized danger. For instance, a weasel would be an example of a small localized danger. It can't jump 20 feet in the air, so you're not going to see a song sparrow rise higher than, say, maybe 5 feet above a weasel. Same thing with a house cat. These birds know, they know the limits of those who are stalking them. They see, you know, the thing that we have to remember is that that song sparrow lives in the yard. That weasel also lives in the same yard. So it's not like that song sparrow only saw that weasel once. That song sparrow sees that weasel every day. And if it's the time of year when the weasel's feeding its young, that song sparrow watches that weasel pass by 10, 12 times in a single morning. I once watched a weasel go back and forth within a 10-minute period 15 times carrying shrews to its nest. So if you're a song sparrow living in that territory, not only do you know that that's a weasel, you know which weasel it is, you know how far it can jump, you know where it always goes, you know its favorite trails and all that sort of thing, and then if you're the song sparrow, you're only going to go far enough to escape that weasel and no further. Okay, so when you think about baseline, you have to take that into consideration. Birds only go far enough and no further. They only stop singing long enough and no longer. Right? They're not going to alter their whole life pattern simply because a predator moves by or comes through. So that's really important to understand. Okay, so looking at these are the four baseline voices, again, just to repeat them, the song, the companion call, the male-to-male aggression, and the begging call. They're all relatively indicative of baseline if you make sure you take into account all the things that I've told you. If you notice that all of the ground birds are feeding, singing, preening, doing things that are sort of relaxed behaviors, then you're probably looking at a baseline situation. Remember that baseline is totally relative, and it's completely relative in terms of how big the alarm is. So, for instance, a weasel in the neighbor's yard may be creating alarm in the corner of the neighbor's yard, but the birds in your yard may not really so much as care. They're all singing. You'll notice that the ground birds are feeding peacefully and comfortably in your yard, but you hear the alarm in the neighbor's yard. So baseline is happening in your yard, but not in the corner of the neighbor's yard. So remember to account for the relative importance of the alarm itself. The greatest alarm comes from the sharp-shinned hawk, and it will silence a forest for 100 yards in all directions. And I watched just a couple weeks ago, I was at the tracker school sitting outside while everyone was inside listening to Tom lecture when a Cooper's hawk flew over the house, over the barn, over the edge of the field and across a whole bunch of transition areas. And it was amazing to hear, first of all, the tide of alarms that was ahead of that approaching hawk by a good 20 seconds. So there was this intense alarm activity on the front. Like a storm was coming. The front, instead of rain and thunder and lightning, what you had was all this erratic vocalization and birds scattering here and there, and all of them were dropping into thickets, into thorn bushes, going into places where a Cooper's hawk wouldn't dare venture. And that was the front, and that was moving along out in front of the birds. And in the background was all this kind of intense vocalization, high-pitched sounds that were sort of ventriloquial. You couldn't tell where they were actually coming from. And then right behind that was silence. And that silence just came over the landscape like a big cylinder. It was so cool, just the cylinder of silence. And once that Cooper's hawk flew over me, I could listen from the direction in which it came. You know how jets leave those trails across the sky? those little steam trails way up there, it was like it had left a steam trail of silence. And you could actually take your ear and listen through this tunnel of silence and hear the river in that one little spot, because there was all bird sounds way off to the right and all bird sounds way off to the left. But there was this tunnel of silence, and way into that silence, you could now hear the river singing in the distance. But when the birds were all making noise a few minutes ago, you couldn't hear the river. So it was a really cool effect that it had. So you could say that baseline was arrested right in that zone, in that cylinder, but off to the right you could hear baseline still going, and off to the left you could hear baseline going. That's because the birds themselves know how close the danger is by the intensity of the alarm. So the birds that aren't affected by the Cooper's Hawk won't stop singing. They know just how far the Cooper's Hawk can go. Remember that. Okay, so that's baseline. And remember, they only go far enough. Okay, something I didn't really explain in great detail in that first tape series is the idea that a ground-feeding bird is most comfortable on the ground. The concept of the shock cord, I like to think of it as a shock cord. So if you're a song sparrow and you're happiest within 12 inches of the ground, and all of a sudden a cat comes through and forces you up, say, 5 feet off the ground, imagine that you have an invisible shock cord that's attached to a ring on your chest and it's wanting to pull you back to the ground again. And think about it that way. That's a lot how bird language is. You know, bird body language especially. If a ground bird has come up, something either forced it up or something pulled it up. And there's definitely a distinct difference between those two kinds of behaviors. For instance, I was lying by a river just the other day along the Musconetcong River. I was listening to the water sing and gurgle along, and all of a sudden I noticed to my right the catbirds started to get really intense. And they were getting very, very intense, and it was a very localized behavior. They were aiming at something that was right near the ground. And then the cardinals came in and chipped, and then the robins flew right into that same zone. So here I had three different birds, three different species all ganging up on whatever that was in the thicket. It turned out to be a weasel. That's what I figured out a little bit later from tracking it. And then the very next day, a friend of mine observed that weasel in the very same spot. So, but just so you know, the birds that were in that zone were being pushed up. For instance, the catbird is very comfortable close to the ground, but the weasel was on the ground, so the catbird had to rise up. But in rising up, you could see that it wanted to be back down because all of its attention was downward. And it was making a lot of noise, and that drew in the birds within the territory, the cardinal and the robin, that also had nests nearby, and they were all intensely talking about that weasel down there. Okay, so those birds were pushed up out of the cover, right? But across the river, I noticed a blackbird, which came to the edge of the river and came up trees. It kept, you know, switching from left to right as it went up branches. And what it was doing was being pulled up. And being pulled up is usually a sign that the danger is over there somewhere, and I'm trying to get a good position to see if I can see what the danger is. And so you might say that because that zone right there, there's a fish weir right there, an old Lenni Lenape fish weir that is a pile of rocks that crosses the river that would act as a bridge. Because that zone right there, that animal trail that the animals are using right along the edge of the river, is used both by weasels and by mink, what's the difference in sound between a weasel alarm and a mink alarm? You know, for the blackbird who lives across the river, the difference isn't going to be that much, you know, that you're going to really notice it. So if I'm the blackbird on the other side of the river and I hear the alarm, the localized weasel family alarm going off in the thicket across the way, what I want to know is it the mink or is it the weasel? Because if it's the weasel, I'm not worried, because that little short-tailed weasel isn't going to try to cross the stream, right? Because it's not capable of crossing the stream. And even if it does get up on that fish weir and use it as a bridge to cross, it has to leap over the current at one point. It's not big enough to do it. Plus, it's exposing itself to the danger of aerial predators at that time. So the blackbird can ease its mind by rising up. In other words, it's being pulled up from the ground to get a look across the river, as opposed to the catbird that's being pushed up from the weasel actually being below it. Does that make sense? When you look across the river as the blackbird, you're trying to establish, okay, what are those birds saying? I know there's a weasel or a mink over there, but what are they saying? Where is this danger? And once it's established, eye contact with the predator itself, or if it can, it will relax. And you'll notice that it will go back to whatever it was doing. So it's like you might call it curiosity, but it's a whole lot more than curiosity that drives a bird to be pulled up from cover to get a view across an opening. Because remember, it's dangerous to expose yourself. When a song sparrow comes out of the thicket and gets up on top of a mulberry bush to get a view of the landscape, it's also exposing itself to the danger of an aerial predator at that time. Or the other thing that it's doing is it's exposing itself to nest robbers. They like to stay hidden because the more secretive they are about where their nests are, the less they have to worry about a crow or a jay coming and stealing their young. So in a way, the birds themselves are like the Apache scouts that have to stay invisible in order to succeed. So it's like a big game of hide and seek going on. Okay, so now just to reiterate, what is this voice of alarm? What does it look like? The voice of alarm is essentially when a predator or a danger is exhibited in the landscape, a bird responds with intense body language, intense vocalization, and that usually is enough to cause all the other birds within the same territory to respond likewise. So when a catbird gives an alarm, the robin and the cardinal respond. Okay? But again, I'm going to repeat, the grosbeak up in the treetop doesn't stop singing because a weasel is on the ground. So the alarm is localized. But the bottom line for an alarm is that it is clearly a multi-species response, okay, and they vary. We'll get into the way they vary when we talk a little bit about the specifics of alarms themselves. So we'll do that on the next tape.
Log on to www.natureoutlet.com for information on John Young and Wilderness Awareness School's classes, expeditions, tapes, home study courses, and intensive mentoring opportunities. Thank you for listening.